Welcome to the Running Explained podcast. I'm Elizabeth, a marathoner, running coach, and answer seeker. When I became a new runner at the age of 29, I had so many questions, but it felt like I was on my own to figure out all of the answers. So now I'm here to answer all your running questions to help make you a better, smarter, faster runner. There's no question too simple and no topic too complex. So let's get started.
Hello, hello, everyone. Welcome to the Running Explained podcast. I am Elizabeth, your host and your guest for this week. This is episode 21 of season 2, and today we are having that muscle cramp episode. We are got my ish together, and we are talking today about muscle cramps. Very specifically, this episode is going to be about exercise-associated muscle cramps. Not side stitches, not other types of cramping that you may experience in your uterus or in your gastrointestinal tract. We are talking specifically today about exercise-associated muscle cramps. The cramps you get mile 16 in a marathon, the cramps you get when you're running or soon after you have finished a session, those typically lower leg muscle cramps. And we'll talk about the state of the research on this topic. And along the way, we're going to learn a little bit more about how your muscles work, because you have to understand how your muscles work to understand what the possible causes of cramping might be. And I am going to straight up say that, believe it or not, nobody's quite sure what causes muscle cramps. We have a lot of theories and some hypotheses about what causes exercise-associated muscle cramping, but you would think, despite the prevalence of this, you know, in some people, cramping is a relatively recurring issue, we still don't really know exactly what causes it. But like I said, there are some theories, and it's probably going to be some combination of the, you know, the possible causes for you, and also depends on the specifics of what is happening to you when you are experiencing your cramps. Because I'm sure, you know, a lot of people learn growing up that, oh, if you're cramping, it's caused by dehydration. Well, no, not exactly. Although there is one possibility that there is cramping can be induced or caused by imbalances to your water and electrolyte balance inside of your body and your cells. And the other theory about what causes muscle cramps has to do with your nervous system, how your muscle cells and your motor neurons communicate with each other. So it's really interesting. And like with all topics on this show, I try to take relatively complex scientific concepts and try to break them down so at least we're all speaking the same language and have a basic understanding of the issue. There is some stuff in this episode that might sound a little technical. If you don't understand it fully, that's okay. If you're coming from a background that is very steeped in anatomy and physiology and biology and chemistry, and you're listening to my explanation of some of these things going, well, that's a vast oversimplification. I know it is. That's the point, right? The point is to make this topic approachable and accessible. And the other thing I want to say is that, unfortunately, I have no answers for you. We are not sure. If I were to specifically tell you, well, muscle cramping is caused by this and this is how you fix it, there isn't that answer. Science has not yet provided us with that answer, although there are some things we can do, some ways to hedge our bets to help hopefully make us into more cramp-proof people. Because this is also going to depend on your specific history of cramping, when it happens, where it happens, in what events, in what conditions, where in your body, right? Is this a recurring issue? Has this happened to you once and then never again? Because every runner is afflicted at least once in their life with some sort of muscle cramp, but the experience between runners is absolutely vast. And that's also one of the issues when studying cramps in a research setting is that, one, cramps are extraordinarily hard to make happen in a setting where you would then be able to study them, right? That's kind of one of the things where, like, well, if you can make it happen, you can figure, you can, you know, study it. You can't even reliably create cramping in a lab setting, which is, I think, one of the big frustrations, right? And then also the experiences, like I said, with athletes, with their cramping is very, very different. So some athletes, some runners will say, well, you know, I tend to experience cramping maybe just on one side, in one calf, in very specific situations, like when I'm doing really hilly events. Okay. Another runner might say, no, it feels like my entire leg, all my legs below the waist, I'm like my whole legs are cramping up. And it kind of seems to happen, you know, whatever I'm doing, but it's really hot out, right? So, and kind of all the way, you know, all the different ways that cramps can affect a runner. And yes, of course, since this is a running related podcast, we're talking specifically about situations where you experience running related cramps, cramps that occur when you are running or directly after you have stopped running. Although that is less likely, that does also happen. Those are still exercise associated muscle cramps. It is also entirely possible, and I am just spitballing here, that what looks like the same thing is actually different in different situations, meaning that maybe, and like I said, this is just my wild stab in the dark here. What if it is both things, both the electrolyte imbalance hypothesis and the neuromotor issue hypothesis are correct? It just depends on the situation that you're in, or experiencing a certain situation, like they exacerbate each other, or, you know, so because there is no denying the fact that athletes, you are more likely to experience muscle cramps in conditions where you are losing lots of sweat, where you are more likely to become dehydrated. You were talking about endurance events in hot and or humid conditions. That is one of the risk factors for cramping. So, you know, I'm kind of backing that up here and saying, well, if that's one of the risk factors for cramping, maybe the electrolyte balance theory holds some weight here. And then, of course, there are some situations where you experience muscle cramping and the weather is perfect and you are like on top of your hydration and you know it's not electrolytes. And they have done studies where they've taken blood and fluids and measured all the, you know, levels of hydration and serum sodium and all these things after an event, and found that in some cases, runners are getting cramps whose, you know, stats are fine. Like, you're not dehydrated, you're not low on anything, and yet you're experiencing muscle cramps. There's actually some, and we're going to talk about some of these studies a little bit later on. There's some really interesting stuff. And, you know, like I said, I don't know, maybe it's a little column A, a little column B. It probably depends. But, you know, I think that the takeaway for this episode, if you have gotten this far and you're like, well, she's not going to give me any answers, I'm just going to turn this off, I would say that there are two things right now that I would say as a coach and as a runner myself that are going to make it less likely that you will experience muscle cramps. And that is to make sure that you are hydrating properly with electrolytes replaced according to your specific loss rates. Some runners vastly underestimate how much sodium specifically they actually lose when they run, especially in hot and humid conditions. So making sure that that is genuinely squared away, especially if you're going to be running in hot and humid conditions. And the second thing is making your body as fatigue resistant as possible. And that can be done through a combination, of course, proper training, but also in your running, but also strength training can help with fatigue resistance. So if you are a runner who has been experiencing cramping in events like the marathon, one of the most common stories, why did I cramp in my marathon? And then that's a whole can of worms, because there's a million things that can go wrong in the marathon, even when you've done everything right. How do we then figure out, oh my gosh, is this something that you did? Did you have any control over this or not? But if you have done zero strength training or very minimal strength training and you're experiencing cramping in these endurance events, add some strength training. As well as making sure your electrolytes and your hydration is figured out. But why? Why to both of those? So that's cool. Sorry, I've kind of gave away the goose at the very, very beginning. Hope you'll stay for the rest of this, because it is really interesting. We're going to learn about how your muscles work. We're going to learn more about why electrolytes are actually important to replace in your body. And then we're going to learn a bit more about how your muscle cells work and how they fire and how they know when to fire and a really interesting theory about why motor neurons kind of get janky sometimes, which might contribute to muscle cramping. So let's start off by describing or explaining how muscle cells work. Because a cramp is basically your muscle spasming in a contracted position that doesn't let go, right? And it can range from, you know, uncomfortable to extraordinarily painful, that can last for several seconds to quite a long time. And it's when your muscle, you know, clenches, cramps, contracts, and you can look at the knot, you can feel the knot, you're like, oh my gosh, why can't I get this cramp out? If you are currently, as you're listening to this episode, experiencing a muscle cramp, stretching actually will help. Doing some static stretching, it has to do with how your body perceives different muscle tensions and then how they react to them. That is a vast oversimplification, but if you are actively experiencing muscle cramp, stopping and stretching that muscle in a static stretch, yes, it's okay, can be helpful to encourage your muscle to release or relax. But we have to understand how our muscles contract and why they contract, and in the first place to understand what might be happening when a muscle cramp occurs, which is that it contracts and then it doesn't release, it doesn't relax. So, like I said at the beginning, we're talking about exercise-associated muscle cramps, which occur exclusively in your skeletal muscle tissue. You have three different types of muscle in your body. You have skeletal muscle tissue, what you think of when you think of your muscles, right? The muscles that attach to the bones and allow you to move and pick things up and run and walk downstairs, skeletal muscle. You also have cardiac muscle that is found exclusively in your heart. And you also have smooth muscle. This is found in things like your digestive tract, mostly in your digestive tract, in your blood vessels, in your respiratory system, like the tissues in your body that are not skeletal muscle, but they're not fat and they're not connective tissue, right? That's muscle, but it's just smooth muscle, which is really, it's just, your body's truly a fascinating place. We're not talking about cardiac or smooth muscle today, we're only talking about skeletal muscle. Your skeletal muscle, broadly, is made of bundles of muscle fibers. Basically, each muscle fiber is a muscle cell, and they all lay down together and create these bundles, like I said, of muscle that create muscle groups. And you have several different types of those muscle fibers, and you've probably heard of these different types called fast twitch and slow twitch muscle fibers. You actually have, it's obviously, everything's always more complicated than that. You have subtypes and it depends on your training, and long story short, broadly speaking, you have two different types of muscle fibers. You have fast twitch and slow twitch. Those are the ones we're going to kind of gloss over. Slow twitch type 1 muscle fibers are the muscle fibers that are what we call fatigue resistant. They are the muscle fibers that are supporting what you're trying to do when you're trying to do endurance running, when you're trying to do any sort of distance or endurance activity. And the way that the muscle cells themselves are set up are that they get a lot of their energy in the muscle cells from an aerobic method of energy production. So slow twitch fibers are relatively small in comparison to your fast twitch fibers. They produce a lower amount of force in comparison. That fast twitch is more of that explosive force, very quick contracting, high levels of force production. Slow twitch fibers have a bunch of mitochondria. Oh, remember the powerhouse of the cell? Your mitochondria is where energy is produced. They have high capillarization, which means they have a lot of blood vessels in them. They have a lot of myelin. They have a high oxidative capacity. What this means is that your slow twitch muscle fibers are really good at using and producing and using energy derived from aerobic methods of energy production. Aerobic meaning with oxygen. That's why all the blood vessels are there to bring the oxygen to the muscle cells. So these long endurance, slow twitch muscle fibers are set up to basically kind of burn low and slow. Like, yeah, they're not super flashy, but they don't produce a crap ton of energy in comparison to the fast twitch fibers, but they keep going for a long, 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 long time. As long as there is oxygen and energy, like, they'll keep going. Of course, like everything in your body, they won't keep going indefinitely. They are fatigue resistant. It doesn't mean they're fatigue proof. And we all fatigue eventually. There's a bunch of other things that happen when fatigue accumulates. So even though your slow twitch muscle fibers are more fatigue resistant than your fast twitch fibers, and they can keep going for much longer, they still do accumulate levels of fatigue. And that fatigue can be marked by muscle damage, you know, basically. It's okay. But there are, the cool thing about this is that there are biomarkers, things we can measure in your blood that basically tell us how damaged are we? How much muscle damage is there? And we'll talk about a study that talks about muscle damage markers in relation to muscle cramping after a marathon a little bit later. But fast twitch muscle fibers in comparison to slow twitch are relatively large, right? So bigger. That's where your explosive energy comes from. That's the sprinting, jumping, powerlifting, anything that requires sudden large bursts of energy. This is going to come from your fast twitch muscle fibers. Most of the energy in these cells is going to come from anaerobic methods of energy production. So they don't have a lot of myoglobin, they don't have a lot of mitochondria, they don't have a lot of capillarization in comparison to the slow twitch fibers, because they don't need to, because a lot of the energy in those cells is coming from anaerobic methods of production, which is a very effective way of producing energy, but also creates a whole bunch of byproducts. And of course, you know, as you may have figured out for thinking about the activities associated with fast twitch muscle fibers, you can't sprint for very long. You can't do explosive things like jump for very long. Those things, like I said, are huge energy, you know, force production, need a lot of energy really fast, but they burn out relatively quickly. It fatigues very, very fast. So those are two different types of muscle fibers. Okay, yes, there are more than that, but broadly speaking. Your muscle fibers, whether they are fast twitch or slow twitch, each individual muscle fiber, when you think about the muscle fiber that it contracts, right? Think about the classic, you know, doing a bicep curl. Just do it with me right now, right? Pretend that you're doing a bicep curl and you're thinking, yeah, I am contracting my bicep to bring my arm up. That is the simplest way we can envision. That's what a muscle contraction is. It shortens. Contraction just means to shorten, right? And then to bring the weight back down, our imaginary weight, whether or not you've grabbed something or not, you're just pretending. The bicep itself then relaxes, but also on the other side, your tricep lengthens eccentrically. So it actually lengthens under force. What does this mean? All this means is that your muscles are either on or they're off, is what this is what I'm trying to illustrate. So your muscles can't contract halfway. Your muscle fibers individually cannot contract a little bit. Either the muscle fiber is contracted or it is not contracted. It is either on or it is off. And the different amounts of force generation, or how you recruit those muscles, the muscle cells needed to do the job you want to do, basically how many of them get involved, right? You know, if I'm lifting nothing in this bicep curl motion, I have an empty hand right here, I am still contracting a various number of muscle fibers in my bicep in order to make that movement happen. However, if I were to do this exact same movement with a very, very heavy weight, I would need to recruit and use far more muscle cells in my bicep in order to allow to produce enough energy to have that force generated to allow my muscle to, you know, bring the actually heavy weight up to my shoulder. So the lesson here, the takeaway is that your muscle fiber either is contracted or it is not. There is no halfway on this, and that the different amounts of force generation have to do with basically how many individual muscle cells get involved and contract simultaneously in order to produce a certain amount of force. Why is this important? Because this is actually important when it comes to talking about the neuromotor theory of why muscle cramps might happen, because it's basically somebody forgot to turn off the on switch. All right, let's talk about the electrolyte imbalance hypothesis, because this is really interesting stuff. And I think that this is where most people go first, right? They say, I experienced a muscle cramp. Oh, must have been something wrong with my electrolytes or my hydration. And I'll just do more next time so it doesn't happen. Some cases, you know, whatever worked, maybe something else changed. Maybe it was the electrolytes. It got better. Sometimes you're like, I did everything right. I increased my, you know, fluid intake. I increased my electrolyte intake and it still happened. So let's talk about the electrolyte. Let's call the electrolyte theory. The origin of this theory and the research around dehydration and lack of sodium causing muscle cramps came from industrial settings, you know, about 100 years ago when they were finding that, you know, heavy laborers, so people who worked like in mines or in ships, you know, feeding the coal into the fires, like imagine Titanic, like the guys down at the bottom of the boat in with the coal shovels, that is brutal work. Steel mill workers, construction workers, so these, you know, yes, all guys, 100 years ago, they were all men. These guys in certain situations were experiencing cramping, and that when sodium tablets or salt or saline drinks were provided, their incidence of muscle cramping went down, right? So that was like, oh, in this situation, this muscle cramping is occurring. We gave them salt and it seems to be helping. So that was kind of the origin of this, dehydration and or electrolyte issues are what's causing muscle cramping. They say if you live long enough, everything old becomes new again. And I don't know that that's true. I may have just made that up. But what I do know is that it does seem like in this year, 2022, somehow the 80s are back in town. And I don't hate it. I mean, I was a little tiny baby just for a small part of the 80s. Yes, that's how old I am. But I never got to live through the 80s the first time. And all that neon, to be honest, looks kind of fun. And I have to say, I am digging the new Gooder sunglass style, the Wrap G. The extremely extreme sunglasses for extremely extreme people. Yes, these look like they belong in some sort of 80s style ski area villain. That's okay. They're very cool and they're very extreme. If you've ever thought to yourself, am I a person who would wear wraparound sunglasses? Am I that extreme? Well, you won't know until you find out. And now you can find out and save 15% off at the same time on Gooder's website using code RUNEXB to save 15% off your next order of Gooder sunglasses. That's code RUNEXP on Gooder.com, GOODR.com. And yes, they have less extreme sunglasses too, don't worry. But when you wear Gooders, you look good and run Gooder. So digging further into some of the research around that time, and as they're like, okay, this seems to be happening, and people start saying, but why? Like, let's observe more. And yes, say what you will about, you know, that kind of people who are required to work that hard with probably very little labor laws in place. However, they tended to keep fairly meticulous records of that kind of thing because they could observe and control almost anything. So it was also observed in one of the original reports, this is from 1923, unbelievable, 99 years ago, that the researcher noticed that it was not only just that the cramping was not occurring as frequently when there were sodium tablets available, that the onset of cramps tended to occur more frequently in high air temperatures, so when it's hot, when there is excessive drinking of water caused by dryness of the mouth and throat, right? So we have really hot conditions, you're drinking a whole bunch of plain water, and then when they're then continued to work hard, okay? So imagine a situation, endurance runner, if you will, and where you are doing a heavy amount of continued hard work in a high temperature environment, and you are drinking a whole bunch of plain water. I think we've all been there, and this is more less about dehydration and more about dysregulation of electrolyte balance within your body. Our body is a really delicate little cell sack. It is a really touchy little thing where if you mess with the balance of all the electrolytes like sodium and chloride and calcium and magnesium, potassium, if you mess with the precise quantities and the precise gradients needed, things are going to happen, bad things, usually bad things. Yes, you're going to have too much, yes, you're going to have too little. And we've talked before in this podcast, and you've probably heard of something called hyponatremia. Hyponatremia actually means low sodium, hypo meaning low, natremia, that's the root. So sodium, the elemental sign for sodium is Na because of whatever they used to call it way back when, natron or something. That's what they made mummies out of. So hyponatremia means low sodium. It refers to having a low serum sodium in your body because you drank too much water, basically. It's more likely to happen in situations that are in hot or humid conditions. You're not replacing electrolytes, and there's some other risk factors as well. But this sounds familiar, right? This sounds familiar. Hot conditions, lots of plain water, continued hard work. And to give a bit more traction to this theory, they did some big follow-up studies to figure out, like, is it the salt? Is it the water? What's going on here? When they were building the Hoover Dam, there were some studies done that looked at, you have a bunch of guys working super hard through the summer in different conditions. And what did they see? So in those situations, they did a study at the Hoover Dam. They did a study when they were building steel mills in Youngstown, Ohio. So in a report published in 1936, they found that the men who were experiencing muscle cramping exhibited dehydration. They had a lowered concentration of sodium and chloride in their blood plasma, right? So low serum sodium and low chloride in their blood. Little or no sodium or chloride in urine. Basically, your body holds on to things that it needs. So if you're not excreting it, you probably needed it. Increased serum protein concentration. This can be a biomarker of muscle damage. And then they did something which would never, ever fly with any ethics board in today's world, but they actually took two different sites at building the mills in Ohio, and they gave the employees at one mill access to saline, salt, and the other mills didn't get access to salt, and the mill that got access to salt had a massive reduction in the incidence of muscle cramps. So it sounds like we solved this in 1936, right? Hey, hot, humid conditions, drinking too much plain water, really hard work. Give them some salt. They'll be fine. Why are we still talking about this? Why is this not the known cause? Why are there still so many question marks? Because the human body is very complicated. Because sometimes when we figure out what we think we know the answer is, finding out the other things that show up in these kinds of studies raise more questions than they provide answers. So one of them is, why doesn't this happen to everyone whenever we are in this kind of environment or situation? Why didn't everybody in that plant or at building the Hoover Dam in an August afternoon get muscle cramps? Why does this not happen to everybody if these conditions seem to be causal for this problem, muscle cramps? Because they've also more recently done studies with marathon runners and with Ironman triathletes and ultramarathon runners. And there is no formula here. There's no, once your sodium dips below this level, you're going to get muscle cramps. Or once your dehydration level reaches this point, you're going to get muscle cramps. That doesn't exist. One of the issues with cramps that we've discussed is that they are notoriously kind of come and go. Without, it seems sometimes, any rhyme or reason. If it were just as simple as this electrolyte imbalance theory being causative of these cramps, then it would be really easy to replicate and we would be able to study them and we would have had this wrapped up decades ago. But that is not the case. However, this electrolyte hydration theory is not closed. This may still contribute and in fact make some runners more susceptible to experience cramping in certain situations. So what does this mean? Basically, becoming imbalanced from an electrolyte standpoint and having issues with dehydration, those can happen independently of each other, by the way. You can be hydrated. You can have enough quote-unquote fluid in your body. Your electrolytes can be imbalanced, though. Or you can be dehydrated and have improperly balanced electrolytes. They can be too high. They can be too low. You can be overhydrated and have low, whatever. There are a lot of different ways that can happen. But long story short, it may seem like being in a dehydrated state or having that electrolyte imbalance may make you more susceptible to then experience muscle cramps with additional factors like that fatigue that we mentioned. So one of the ways that they try to induce cramping in the laboratories with electrical stimulation in your electrically induced cramping. And that seems to be able to be replicated in situations where these subjects are also in a state of dehydration and imbalanced electrolytes compared to subjects who are not dehydrated and have balanced electrolytes. So it's one of those things where, like we talked about, Might be multiple factors at play here, and it kind of just depends. Yes, I mean, in general, we know that dehydration and imbalanced electrolytes contribute to poor performance. The more dehydrated you get and the more imbalanced your electrolytes become, like, the less you're able to do, the worse your performance is going to get. It would make sense that then that would open the door to the susceptibility of other issues, potentially like muscle cramping, which, like we've talked about, may have some fatigue causes as well. How or why does this work with the electrolyte thing? So, now I don't want to get too technical here because we're going to get technical in the next section on neuromotor control. But generally speaking, the way that your muscles contract is that you can imagine your cell back from when you learned in biology class. And, you know, muscle cells are fibers, like muscle cells are long and skinny. And so they're not that nice, plump, round cell that we typically think of. We think of the cell with the nucleus and the mitochondria, which are the powerhouses of the cell, which I have been in this space for years now, and I still cannot say mitochondria without following up with the powerhouse of the cell. But we have different organelles and things in each muscle fiber, in each muscle cell. One of those organelles is called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. What is sarcoplasm? What's a sarcoplasmic anything? So, in your muscle cells specifically, the contents of your cell and the kind of general fluid that the organelles, etc., float around in inside it is called the sarcoplasm versus cytoplasm, C-Y-T-O, plasm, which is what is inside like other cells. So muscle cells are just a little bit different. This is only striated, this is only muscle cells, skeletal muscle fibers. So sarcoplasm is cytoplasm, but in muscle cells. So your sarcoplasmic reticulum is where your calcium ions hang out. You need these. These do things. When your muscle cell receives the signal to contract, what happens is the sarcoplasmic reticulum dumps a whole bunch of calcium ions out into your actual muscle fiber, into the sarcoplasm, and that is what triggers the actual contraction in the muscle fiber itself. Not going any further than that in this conversation. This is not a discussion about how your muscles contract. All you have to know is that in your muscle cell, you have the sarcoplasmic reticulum that has a little warehouse for your calcium ions. Biologists, please don't hate me. That when your cell gets a signal, you gotta contract, it dumps all the calcium ions out into the fluid in your cell, and those calcium ions then allow other things to occur, allow other reactions to take place. Once they're no longer needed, once your cell no longer, your muscle cell doesn't have to contract anymore, once that signal to contract is removed, what happens is that those calcium ions then get pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The pump that facilitates this active transport, right? Remember, we have active transport, we have passive transport. This active transport of shoving the calcium ions back into their house is done with a pump called a sodium-potassium pump. This is really important. And already you can say, okay, well, hold on. Those are really important electrolytes. Is this where the sodium comes in? And potassium, I know, is really important. And yeah, that's the theory. Theory is that it's not the calcium. Calcium dumps out, gets pumped back in, dumps out, gets pumped back in. And this happens, I mean, like faster than you can even think that it's happening. And the theory is that when electrolyte imbalance occurs and when electrolytes are depleted to a certain point, specifically that sodium, use a lot of sodium in your sweat, especially in those hot and humid conditions, is that when the sodium is no longer present in such quantities that allows a sodium-potassium pump to work properly, then the calcium can no longer be pumped back in to the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and therefore the muscle contraction never gets to turn off. That basically it's stuck in this contracted position because the calcium ions are still present. Remember, your muscle cell is either on or off. It's either contracted or it's not. And when it's basically like stuck in this contracted position, it's because the pump can't work to get the calcium ions out of here and back into their house and release the muscle, basically. That's broadly, really broadly, the theory of why the electrolyte, possibly dehydration, you know, dishydration, dysregulation of hydration, theory of muscle cramping it may happen, may occur. One theory, like I said, and that makes sense, right? There's a century of research that backs up that what we know about when cramping is more likely to occur, and that in situations where sodium is offered alongside proper amounts of hydration, cramping seems to occur less often. Okay, but what about the other theory, the fancy theory, the neuromotor theory? Let's talk about that. This theory actually doesn't start inside the cell. It starts outside the cell. Remember when I just said when the muscle cell receives the signal to contract, we're starting at the signal. This has to do with your nervous system, your nerves, your neurons, the signals that are sent from your brain to the rest of your body that tell your body to do things. So we're talking about motor neurons. These are neurons, which are nerve cells, specifically related to communicating with your muscles to make you do things, right? Your motor neurons help you move, help control your movements, help you move in the way that you want to move. So the motor neuron theory of muscle cramping originates in that nervous system, in your neurons, in the signals that are being sent to your cells to begin with. Not necessarily what's happening inside the cell, but the signal being sent to your cell, that's where the problem might lie. So thinking of the cramps as being neurological in origin is interesting. And it really messes with people to think about things that way. But my goodness, our bodies are unbelievable, very complicated. So yeah, there are a lot of things that are going on completely outside of your conscious control that have a lot of neurological, which just means nerve, involvement. So this theory called altered neuromuscular control, or the motor neuron hypothesis for muscle cramping, this came about in the 80s and the 90s when researchers were noticing that muscle cramping was occurring in conditions which weren't super hot and humid. And the athlete, as sport nutrition became better and better, they weren't becoming dehydrated and they were taking electrolytes, and yet cramping didn't go away, right? We didn't eradicate cramping. It's still here. If it were just as simple as staying hydrated and making sure you're getting enough salt, we would have fixed it by now, but clearly that is not the case. So some researchers came up with this theory that hypothesizes that there is a muscular fatigue and neurological component to why the muscle cramps occur. Now, the origins and the causes of muscle fatigue are fascinating and genuinely deserve their own entire episode and many, many additional years of study, because we are still just starting to learn what fatigue actually is and all the many, many, many ways that fatigue can occur and accumulate in our muscle cells, in our nervous system. There is, a neurological component. There is a whole bunch of stuff that can contribute to levels of fatigue, but it helps just to think about very simply what fatigue actually means. Get tired, right? We are not machines, we are people, and that even though, like I said, those slow twitch muscle fibers are more fatigue resistant, they will eventually wear out. Things eventually get tired, right? No matter how fit you are, eventually you're gonna get tired. You're gonna fatigue that you're so much you're gonna need to stop, take a break, take a nap, eat some food, recharge, rest, right? Fatigue happens to everything in our body if we keep using it without rest or without adequate rest and recovery. So just think of fatigue just being what you would think of fatigue, to get tired. That is just going to help simplify this whole situation. So as you are going along and as your muscle cells and the rest of your body begins to fatigue, that's where this hypothesis jumps in as a possible explanation. Because, you know, when you get tired, things start to get a little weird. Signals start to get a little bit crossed. You start to get a little bit like, oh yeah, no, you're not as sharp, right? Fatigue happens to every level of our body. So think of a situation in which you are actively using your muscle cells. Let's say you're running a marathon or a 5K, 10K, half marathon. You are engaging in an endurance event. Maybe you're a triathlete. Maybe you're swimming. Maybe you're riding. Maybe you're just doing an epic session on the elliptical. I don't know. Whatever it is, you've been doing it for a while and you are starting to fatigue. Now, you may not necessarily feel, oh, I'm fatigued, but as we know, your muscles are fatiguing, right? And what we try to do when we train properly is become as fatigue resistant as possible to try to train our body to work as hard as we want it to meet the demands of our event. And that's one of the most important parts of training. But of course, you will accumulate fatigue, especially with hard work, as the event continues, as your session continues, as your race continues, your muscle cells will fatigue. Now, the theory about how the neuromotor cause of cramping happens, remember when I said the signal goes into your muscle cell and that calcium ions go out, muscle contracts, calcium ions get pumped back in, muscle relaxes? It's a bit more complicated than that because, of course, it is. So there are a bunch of other things that exist in your muscle cell, because here's the question. How does your muscle cell know to relax, right? What tells it to relax? Does it relax on a schedule? Like, is it just that the calcium ions get pumped back in after a certain period of time? Like, how does the muscle know it's time to contract? This is actually controlled by a couple of different little detectors, receptors that monitor the state of your muscle that it's currently in. And so one of those is called the muscle spindle. And this is a stretch detector. And the muscle spindle senses how much and how fast your muscle is being lengthened or shortened, right? So the muscle spindle's job is to understand the current, you know, how am I stretched? Am I short? How fast is this happening? What's going on? And it communicates that information back to your nervous system so that your nervous system can adjust if needed, can make changes, can understand, you know, hey, I sent the signal. Oh, this is where we are. This is where we are, right? It's a constant like game of making, like pinging back, right? Where are we? What's happening? Are we doing the right thing? Do I need to make adjustments? And this is happening. All of these things happen faster than we can even comprehend. So the muscle spindle's job is to detect and then to communicate back, like I said, those changes in your muscle length and how fast those changes are occurring. The muscle spindle is also directly involved in activating the on button, the on switch to tell your muscle to contract, right? So when the muscle spindle is doing its monitoring and detecting, what it can do is make sure that when it needs to, it can tell the muscle to turn on, it can tell the muscle to contract, right? So the muscle spindle is involved in turning on your muscle, broadly speaking. The other detector here is called the Golgi tendon organ. You can think of that as the equal and opposite companion to the muscle spindle. The Golgi tendon organ's job is to detect the current level of tension in the muscle. So tension is different from stretch. So basically this helps receive, understand, communicate back to your central nervous system how tense the muscle is. Basically, is it contracted? And the Golgi tendon organ's job, one of its jobs, is to tell your system to turn off, right? So how do calcium ions get pumped back into their little house? They get told to because the Golgi tendon organ went, hey guys, we're good here, you can turn off now. And then the signal, you know, was turned off and your muscle is then relaxed or is no longer actively contracting. The motor neuron theory here is that when, as your muscle fatigues, the theory is that the signal from the Golgi tendon organ basically becomes weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker to the point where it's not able to communicate back to your central nervous system effectively to say, hey, turn off, we're good here. Therefore, your muscle stays in that contracted, cramped position. Interesting stuff, right? So, you know, what does this tell us, right? How do we prevent fatigue? What does it mean to become fatigued? And one of the most frustrating things about the literature on this topic is that they tend to refer to it as, when talking about the neuromotor theory of muscle cramping, is that they call it premature fatigue. And yeah, I mean, I understand what they're getting here is that basically they're saying, yeah, when your muscles become fatigued faster than you expected. And that's like, okay, well, that's not helpful because I didn't expect them to fatigue that quickly, right? So I think what kind of the layperson's term, if I were to communicate this to one of my athletes and say, you know, what we're trying to do here is make sure that, yes, as you are engaging in this level of activity that's going to fatigue you, we want to make sure that you're not doing things that are going to contribute to too much fatigue too quickly, and also take steps to make sure that you are making yourself as fatigue resistant as possible given the demands of your event, right? So training properly, getting the volume in for those high long distance events, getting the time on feet in general, and then also doing things like strength training in the run up to your training, in the run up to your race specific training cycle. But also making sure you're doing things like not going out too fast, that you have a good pacing strategy in place, that you have handled training in accordance with the course demands, right? So you've prepared for hills, you've prepared for whatever the race is going to be. So the things that, assuming that, of course, you're going to fatigue over the course of your event, like that's going to happen, we want to make sure is that you're not fatiguing faster than you should be, especially in situations which you are more likely to fatigue, like hot, humid, hilly races. So it's kind of like the trifecta of like, yeah, that sounds like it would cause some problems. And, you know, I think that the thing we can't discount with all of this, and even the research says, and I'm quoting directly from an article here in the New Zealand Journal of Sports Science, you know, in ending the discussion on the neuromotor control theory, that, quote, "This still does not explain why cramp is not an inevitable consequence of exercise that causes fatigue, why it appears to occur more frequently in environments that impose high thermal stress, or why some individuals are affected while others are not," end quote. This is scientists' way of saying, yeah, we still like have no idea. Like we have a whole bunch of like possibles, but there's so many questions left to answer, which is frustrating for all of us, right? I think one of my most frustrating things as a coach, when I very first started researching this subject, you think muscle cramps, they have to have an easy answer because they've been around forever and it's kind of a big deal, right? Is that one of the risk factors for experiencing exercise associated muscle cramping is a history of muscle cramping. Like that's a it's like such circular logic, but it's true. There are some people who seem to be more prone to cramps than others. There are some people who may experience cramping once or twice in their entire like athletic career, but it never like it kind of came out of blue and like kind of then went away and they never experienced it again. And there are some other people who may deal with persistent recurring cramping in certain situations. So what can we do? Well, coming full circle to the very beginning of this episode, now as we're reaching towards the end of this, doing things that just help safeguard against situations in which cramping may occur, right? So the hydration and electrolyte thing, that's just important to do whether or not you are prone to cramping or not. Making sure that you are ingesting adequate fluids and electrolyte replacement for the specifics of your conditions, right? So hot and humid environments require more electrolyte and more fluid intake. If needed, adjusting your effort and or pacing in conditions that are more strenuous, especially hot, humid, hilly, all of the above, right? So if you have experienced leg cramps at, you know, mile 10 of your half marathon, but it's 85 degrees and it's 80% humidity and you refused to change your original pacing strategy despite the conditions, I mean, hello, dehydration and fatigue, right? Because heat is stress. Heat increases fatigue. You have to remember that fatigue is not just like fatigue actually is caused by things that cause stress, right? The higher level of stress, which for a lot of runners means intensity. Heat adds stress. So heat can increase the level of intensity or effort. As temperature rises, we all know we have to slow down to maintain the same effort level because heat adds stress. So all of this relates back to making the adjustments that you need to in the conditions you are given on the day that you have. And like I said earlier about stretching, and now knowing what we know about how your muscle detector receptors figure out what is happening in your muscle and relay that back to your central nervous system, if you are actively experiencing a muscle cramp, let's say in the middle of a race, not a great time to have one, but high level of effort relative to what you do in training, right? On race day, you're trying to do something that you have never done before in most cases. You are trying to hold a higher level of effort for a longer duration than you've ever done before. So when these things happen on race day, like, don't be surprised. For most people, when they go out and participate in a race, this isn't an easy run, right? You're there to throw down. You're there to test your limits. And with that limit testing, of course, comes an additional heightened fatigue because your effort's higher for longer than it's ever been. And so, you know, when these things happen on race day only, think about the fatigue. Also consider the conditions, right? What is happening on the day in question? If you are in a race and or even in a workout and you get a cramp, so the advice for this is to slow down because cramping tends to be resolved if you remove the work being done by the muscle. Slow down or stop. Do a gentle stretch. Can't hurt to drink some water and get some electrolytes, right? Walk for a little bit. If it cramps when you start running again, if you immediately experience a muscle cramp again, that is, give it a bit more time, right? There are some situations where in a race, you may be able to fight the cramps off. If it is more of a, you know, you just needed to kind of reset and give yourself some recovery with the fatigue, or maybe get some electrolytes and hydration in you, and that helped a lot. So the struggle with this is that there is no fix, there is no cure, because we don't know what the cause is, but we can make some educated guesses, right? If you have a history of recurring muscle cramps and you are not doing strength training, start doing strength training. If you have a history of recurring muscle cramps and you don't really take water on most runs, start really getting really serious about your fluid intake. Hydration, water, and electrolytes, especially in hot and humid conditions. I personally recommend taking water on anything that's, you know, longer than 30 minutes, just in case, right? Water is not weakness. Your body is mostly water. You kind of need it. You are not doing yourself any favors by becoming dehydrated intentionally. And yeah, electrolyte replacement, you know, especially on things over an hour, especially in hot and humid conditions, but even in really hot and humid conditions on runs that are shorter than that. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, I don't understand why people are so resistant to drinking some water, taking some salt, take a little gel here or there, right? Fuel your body, and in return, it will do amazing things for you. Hydrate well, keep those electrolytes up, make sure you're training properly, do some strength training. These will help insulate you against the likelihood of muscle cramping. Although, like I said, there is no 100% preventative guarantee that we know of, because we're not even quite sure exactly what causes them, which is one of the most frustrating things when you're trying to help people solve their problems so they don't get muscle cramps again. Now, obviously, as soon as we do have an answer, you guys will be the first to know, because I'm going to be jumping up and down saying they figured it out. As we know, though, science is a bit messier than that. It's probably not going to be that. We're probably just going to learn a little bit more about specifically the how and the why of what I'm assuming is the interaction effect between these two hypotheses. The general research suggests that, yeah, it's probably both. We're not quite sure how or why, but they both seem to kind of be at play here. And the fascinating thing about the field of sport science is that it also just helps us figure out how our bodies work, right? How many of you knew about the Golgi tendon organ before today? Probably not many of you. And now you know. Now you know a little bit more about how your body works, because you're learning about it in a performance capacity, but that still translates to you knowing more about yourself as a human being and how other human beings move as well. One more thing, actually, before we go. I'm recording this a little bit later on. This is the stuff that keeps me up at night. Did I actually follow through on talking about those biomarkers of muscle damage like I said? No, I did not. And this is actually really cool, and this is why I wanted to just pop in and talk about it before we actually go today. But remember how I skated over the definition of fatigue? Oh, fatigue is just, think of it as your body gets tired. There actually obviously is a lot more to it than that. And fatigue, there are certain ways we can measure fatigue with, like I said, biomarkers of certain things in your blood or your urine or whatever fluid we are currently testing. And one of those things is called creatine kinase. And creatine kinase is a protein. It's an enzyme. Enzymes are proteins, but they are found in high levels when there is muscle damage occurring. So you always have a little bit of creatine kinase circling around, just because that's just what happens. But when creatine kinase is elevated beyond normal, that is a signal that there is muscle damage. It is elevated in the presence of muscle damage. And muscle damage is just a way of saying fatigue, right? Fatigue happens. Muscles get damaged. This is all very normal. Just remember back to learning about how your muscles get bigger and stronger. They get micro damaged and then they repair themselves. That's all part of the normal process. But creatine kinase is something we can measure in your body to see how damaged are you. It's normal to find elevated levels of creatine kinase after things like a marathon or other very hard, very taxing efforts. But I wanted to circle back to the study that I vaguely referenced earlier, because this is really interesting. This kind of ties it all together in that little bit of this, little bit of that, and also another plug for strength training. So this was a study that was done that was published this month, June 2022. This is the latest and the greatest. And of course, it's really hard to test subjects in the field, but it's hard to also get people to come into a lab and run a marathon. So of course, understanding, you know, when you're critically evaluating research, understanding the context in which the research is taking place and all the different variables that one could consider, and of course the things that we cannot control for, but whatever, we're not talking about how to design research. So this is a study that they did, and they took 98 marathon runners who are going to run a road marathon, not a trail marathon, not a treadmill or track marathon, and they did some blood work before, and they did some blood work after. So of these 98 runners, 88 of them finished. 20 of those runners had developed exercise-associated muscle cramping, so skeletal muscle cramping, during or immediately after the race. So classic running exercise-related muscle cramping. And then they, of course, compared all of the information of between, you know, the runners who had experienced cramping with the runners who hadn't experienced cramping. What they do is they try to look for, you know, relationships and patterns here in the data. So what they found is that runners who had muscle cramps, and what they found was the runners who experienced muscle cramps had pretty much the same levels of serum sodium and potassium. And they, you know, of course, probably a little bit dehydrated, but not like significantly, right? So they're thinking, okay, well, the electrolyte thing, that's, you know, they're the muscle, one of the guys who got the people who got the cramping, that's not different from the people who didn't cramp. But what was different in the cramping group, the runners who did experience cramping, was that they had significantly greater post-race creatine kinase and lactate dehydrogenase, which is another enzyme that can signal markers of damage. And in then 24 hours after the race, those two values were also still elevated. So here we have 88 runners, 20 of them got cramps. In all 88 runners, roughly speaking, their electrolyte hydration fluid stuff was all relatively normal within the group. But the ones who cramped had much higher levels of muscle damage, the biomarkers of muscle damage. The other thing to note is that they actually asked these runners about their strength training habits, and the difference in the runners who strength trained in the cramping versus non-cramping group approached statistical significance. So that's a sciencey way of saying that actually the data shows that the ones who strength trained were less likely to get cramping than the ones who didn't strength train. As in, strength training may be a protective factor in cramping. So what do we have here? We have one study done recently that gives more weight to the muscle fatigue and damage and neuromotor theory. But again, there is a whole wealth of evidence that also says, well, don't discount the whole thing when it's hot and it's humid, because that also is very real and that happens too. So biomarkers of muscle damage. If you've ever gotten a really serious blood test, really like in if you've done an Inside Tracker Ultimate panel where they measure literally everything under the sun, you've probably had your creatine kinase measured. So it's something that can be measured in your blood. There are other ways of measuring muscle damage that involve extremely painful and invasive things like muscle biopsies. Obviously, when you're designing research, you don't want to do the most invasive thing possible, even though it would give you the most amount of data. You can't just walk around taking muscle biopsies from people who just ran a marathon. So we're all like, we're just trying to, you know, use the what we have available to us, and it's pretty easy to take blood. So what does this say? What does this mean? What is my little postscript here after all of this? As I woke up in a cold sweat last night saying, I never talked about biomarkers of muscle damage. It doesn't really change anything. I just wanted to illustrate this to you and say this is a really interesting new piece of research that is adding to our pile of research on the topic. And again, say to you, stay on top of your hydration and electrolytes, train properly for your event, and include strength training. That might be the missing piece of the puzzle here. It definitely can't hurt. I hope that you have gotten a little bit more information about muscle cramps, exercise-associated muscle cramping, and a little bit more of the understanding of the history, the how, and the why. Fascinated by this stuff. This stuff is so interesting. So thank you for listening. If you've made it all this way, I want to remind you that we do still have fall group registration going on. If you're running a half or full marathon in the fall, we do have groups available. There is no pace requirement. All you have to do is just be excited to train for your upcoming race. And if you are interested in a training plan or one-on-one coaching, we have options, the team of coaches and a variety of training plans for runners of many experience levels, definitely new runners up through what I call roughly intermediate runners. If anybody here is listening and they are what we might call a sub-elite or competitive runner, I don't know. Level 4 might be your jam, but we might be looking at level 5 and beyond for you. But for everybody else, for the rest of us, there is probably a plan for you at a variety of distances, 5K through marathon, something for everyone. So until next time, thank you so much for being here. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Don't forget, you can always find and follow me on Instagram at Running Explained. And if you're looking for a coach or a training plan, check me out. Visit my website, runningexplained.co. That's runningexplained.co. See you next time. This content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you have regarding a medical condition.